Hi there, I'm Marco Werman. Every day our program has hundreds of thousands of listeners from all around the globe. If everyone who listened to The World donated during our drive, we'd be set for a while. That's just not possible for everyone. Times are tough. But if you are in a position to give, and if our show has touched you, if it's helped you feel more connected or perhaps more optimistic about the world around you, then please donate today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you very much. And now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
On the border of Belarus and Poland, migrants are clamoring to get into the European Union. Belarusian strongman Alexander Lukashenko sent them to the border.
Angela Merkel, the outgoing chancellor of Germany, she referred to Lukashenko's tactics as state-backed human trafficking.
Also today, in French-speaking Quebec, an unpopular press conference in English lands an airline executive in trouble.
At this point, he's definitely going to have to learn French. Air Canada said he's in classes.
And New Zealand has been a model for battling the pandemic, but that does not mean it's been easy.
In these small pockets, there have been these, like, absolute experiences of cruelty.
Plus, the latest from the UN's climate conference and a very fishy story about a long wait at baggage claim. I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Tensions are flaring along a crossing point into the European Union. Desperate crowds trying to cut a barbed wire border fence to get in. On one side of that barbed wire is Belarus and thousands of migrants, mostly from Africa and the Middle East, chanting together their German. On the other side of the wire, Poland and Polish border guards. The migrants have been led to the Belarus-Poland border by the government in Belarus, with belief that this would be their entry ticket into the European Union. But EU countries like Poland have steadfastly denied their entry. I'm joined now by Moscow-based reporter Matthew Luxmore, has been following the story. So in recent days, you visited this border area. Where were you exactly? And tell us what you saw.
Sure. I was in the town of Hajnówka, which is in Poland, in eastern Poland, very close to the border with Belarus. And through this town, every single day, you had military trucks and hardware passing on its way to shore up the border. Poland's taken a very hard line on this issue. So it's sent around 12,000 troops to the border area. And occasionally you saw some migrants coming through the town. They get desperate when they're in the forest because they spend many, many days quite often without food or water until they locate a package left by local Polish activists. And when they get desperate, they often come into the towns searching either for maybe a smuggler who can take them on towards Warsaw or Germany, where most of them want to ultimately end up and seek asylum. Or they're basically picked up by the Polish military or police and quite often pushed back into Belarus, where they have to start the whole arduous journey through the forest again.
Mm. And a moment ago, we heard some of those migrants on the Belarus side chanting German. Germany being their ultimate destination, is that why?
Most of the migrants I spoke to saw Germany as their ultimate destination. They see Germany as a much more welcoming country for migrants. Poland refused to accept EU quotas during the big migrant crisis in 2015, while Germany accepted, I think, around 2 million of them.
Matthew, rewind for us a moment. How did thousands of migrants from the Middle East and Africa end up along Belarus's border with EU countries like Poland?
Well, Belarus has really established itself in recent weeks as the primary, I think, route for migrants into Europe. And the simple reason why is because the regime of Alexander Lukashenko has almost introduced a visa-free regime for a whole bunch of countries, including Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria. Many of these migrants, until quite recently, when it seems Belarus has toughened up the rules a little bit, they could just buy a plane ticket, fly into Minsk, and pick up a visa at the airport. They read these upbeat Arabic language forums, which suggests that this is a pretty smooth passage to Germany. But when they actually come to Belarus and they're transported from Minsk to the border, and they're pushed through to Poland with help from Belarusian border guards, many of them don't expect the conditions that they encounter, the very cold and rough conditions and the lack of food and water after days and days in the forest. Critics of Lukashenko say that he's essentially weaponizing migrants in order to put major pressure on Poland and Germany and Lithuania and Latvia, which are two EU countries that the migrants have also been heading towards, as a way of placing pressure on Europe, on Brussels, in order to bring them to the negotiating table and maybe get some of those sanctions that have been slapped on his regime scrapped.
So when you were on the Polish side, did you meet any migrants when you were there?
Yes, I met a bunch of migrants. I met a Syrian family, which was essentially stuck in a forest ditch waiting for a signal from a smuggler to take them onto Germany. And their son, his name is Raki Sror, he's actually received asylum status in Germany in 2016. He was in this town. He was staying there, trying to facilitate their transfer from the forest through to Germany. And ultimately, this family actually made it out, but they had spent 22 days in the forest with very little food or water, alongside an Iraqi asylum seeker and his wife, who was 6 months pregnant. And they all managed to make it out and onto Germany. But that was kind of the most moving story that I found. And it was also the story that I felt best illustrated this whole issue.
Finally, Matthew, how have EU countries responded to this crisis? I mean, don't they see the sand that President Lukashenko is throwing into the gears?
Yeah, I think EU leaders are perhaps in a difficult position because on one hand, you have a Polish right-wing government, which has its own spat with Europe. And on the other hand, I think they want to make clear that Lukashenko's actions are not acceptable. You can't weaponize people in order to glean your own benefits from a situation and try and get sanctions lifted. So I think we've seen a fairly muted response from the EU. I mean, Angela Merkel, the outgoing chancellor of Germany, she referred to Lukashenko's tactics as state-backed human trafficking. That's probably the most strong statement I've seen on this issue. But it seems like we may see new sanctions on Lukashenko's regime and perhaps a tougher line from Europe. But so far, I think we've just seen a lot of concern expressed.
Moscow-based reporter Matthew Luxmore speaking with us about the developing migrant crisis at the border between Belarus and Poland. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Imagine someone was secretly using your phone to listen to your every conversation, see everyone you've called, and steal all your passwords. That's what Pegasus spyware does. It was developed by the Israeli security firm NSO Group. This summer, it was discovered that the spyware had been sold to dictators and repressive governments across the globe. And yesterday, Pegasus was discovered being used against their adversaries, this time on the phones of six Palestinian human rights activists, including Ubay Aboudi, who joins us now. Ubay, can you start by telling us how you found out your phone had been hacked using Pegasus?
The Pegasus software does not only hack your phone and view your passwords, your connections, etc., but it also can manipulate the data on your phone, make phone calls without you consenting to them, send messages to other people, and even download content and upload content from your phone. So it's quite a vicious software. Actually, our colleague from Al-Haq first discovered his phone when he had someone call him and tell him, you called me a couple of minutes ago. And he said he didn't. So they took a screenshot of the call logs and compared them, and they weren't matching. So that's quite scary. So we checked our phones after that, and my phone turned out to have a Pegasus software on it.
Well, your organization, the Bisan Center for Research and Development, where you're the executive director, what does Bisan do? And does that lead you to any suspicions why you might have become a target for your work?
Our organization has been, I think, a cornerstone for Palestinian civil society. We've been very active in exposing violations against Palestinian communities, partnering with UN bodies, with European governments, talking to diplomats, other human rights defenders, activists around the world on a number of issues and promoting human rights.
Who do you think might have had reason to hack your phone?
Well, there are only two parties that are really interested, the Palestinian Authority and the occupation forces of Israel. And from understanding is that the Palestinian Authority doesn't have access to this kind of software or vicious weapon.
But right now, you don't know who planted the spyware on your phone.
Well, we don't know, but we can have a very educated guess. It was on the 17th of October. Our colleagues at Al-Haq, a well-known Palestinian human rights organization, called us for a meeting over Zoom, and they told us that there has been hackings of Pegasus on a number of human rights defenders' phones, so we could have to check our phones. As the Israeli occupation forces, since the discovery of the Pegasus software, have declared our human rights organizations as terrorist organizations. And this kind of software is only permitted to be used against in preventing terrorism or against terrorist targets or in preventing acts of criminal acts.
Ubay, let me go back a second. When you learned that someone at Al-Haq had been hacked during that Zoom meeting you were talking about, did that line up time-wise with Israel labeling Bissan, Al-Haq, and other NGOs terrorist groups?
Yeah, actually. Al-Haq found out on the 16th. Al-Haq on the 17th informed us. And on the 19th, six organizations were declared as terrorist organizations. Of course, this timeline suggests that they did those actions in a hurry to cover up something they have done. Having surveillance for such long periods and such invasive technology on human rights activists is totally illegal, even according to Israeli law.
I'm curious, did your phone behave normally after it was hacked? I mean, did you notice anything weird in how it functioned?
Well, I did not notice anything weird. That was actually shocking for me. I used this phone like any normal person does.
So, Ubay, we're catching you at home in the middle of your day. You were just hanging out with your family, in fact, before you stepped out to talk to us. How does your family feel about what's happened?
Well, my kids, thankfully, they do not know what has happened. And we're trying to shield them. My wife, when she knew, the first three nights, she couldn't sleep even. And she was just imagining what kind of horrors she might find out later. For example, private photos on the internet, private communications among me and my wife, because this program also can operate the camera without you knowing, can operate the microphone without you knowing it. This kind of intrusion is really a nightmare for us as a family.
Well, experts who examined your phone say it was hacked sometime last February. I mean, how does it feel knowing that all this time, until October, when this revelation was made, it was being used to monitor you?
Well, you lose the sense of privacy, you know. You feel that even now that I have changed my phones, I don't feel that I have any privacy anymore. I don't feel that I am living safely. I don't feel any sense of security from my part.
I'm curious, have you taken new protective measures with your communication devices? I mean, can you ever trust your phone again?
Of course not. I cannot trust my phone again. I'm also thinking of a way also to protect the people that I communicated with, survivors of political violence or of gender-based violence. We need to protect their data and their privacy, because sometimes this data can be used against them. And this is the scariest thing for me also.
Ubay Aboudi is the executive director of Bissan Center for Research and Development. He is one of six Palestinian activists who discovered recently that their phones had been hacked with the Pegasus spyware developed by the Israeli company NSO Group. Ubay spoke with us from just outside Jerusalem. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. And be safe.
I hate it when I travel and my bag is the last one to come out on the baggage carousel. Then again, I have not flown since 2019, so I can't really complain. Michael Brownholtz of Dorset, England, however, he does get grumbling rights. He told British broadcaster ITV that he and his family were coming back from a vacation in Cyprus. The flight home had been uneventful.
You know, and everything had gone well at the airport on the way out. Everything had gone well during the flight. Kids had been great. And we're ahead of time. I said, this is all just going really well, like almost too well.
Then he threw baggage claim. The first bag comes out. It's a blue crate of frozen fish. Brownholtz doesn't think much of it. A second crate comes out, more frozen fish.
And another one came out, and then another one came out. So three or four, and I was like, wow, that's like someone's put on like loads and loads of frozen fish.
By the 40th crate, he knew something was not right. Someone at British Airways had confused cargo with baggage. Brownholt says some passengers were really mad, but he kind of got mesmerized by the never-ending conveyor belt of uniform blue boxes of frozen fish.
Because it was quite beautiful going around on, you know, they were all the same. You know, somebody could do a conceptual piece of art with this, really.
British Airways said all the luggage has been reunited with the rightful owners. No word on the fish. It's the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Vietnam has recorded nearly 23,000 deaths from COVID. The country's also dealt with the ensuing economic toll, shuttered factories, lost jobs, and cities under lockdown, and now many Vietnamese going hungry. The guidance for citizens from Vietnam's ruling Communist Party, stay strong and tap into Vietnam's famous power of resilience. But that message is being undermined by a scandalous video shot in a London steakhouse. The world's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen reports.
Tho Lam is one of the most powerful men in Vietnam. Not only does he sit on the ruling Politburo, but he's also the head of domestic security in the country. And last week, Tho Lam was in London, en route to the UN Climate Change Conference. And being a lifelong communist, he made time to lay flowers on the grave of Karl Marx. That made the newspapers in Vietnam. But while in London, Tho Lam did something else that his government would like to cover up. That is a video of Tho Lam eating a sizzling slice of steak covered in a sheet of gold, literally. The clip is from the TikTok account of a Turkish-born chef named Nusrat Gökçe. He's better known as Salt Bae, a flamboyant chef and sex symbol who cooks gold-plated steaks for people like Leonardo DiCaprio, P. Diddy, or the King of Morocco. And apparently, Tho Lam as well. Salt Bae personally dangled a piece of steak into his mouth. The video has gone somewhat viral in Vietnam.
I'm not saying 90% of Vietnamese people know about it, but at least 20%, I would say. But 20% is enough.
Dr. Hai Hong Nguyen is with the Center for Policy Futures at the University of Queensland in Australia. He says watching the clip in Vietnam usually requires getting around the government's firewall. But those who have seen it are not impressed.
The criticism is very strong. A lot of people are jobless. A lot of people are in hunger.
Yeah, Minister Tho Lam picked a terrible time to visit Salt Bae. Not just because Vietnamese people are suffering under the pandemic, but the Communist Party is also waging an anti-corruption drive. And it's no joke. A few years back, an ex-member of the 18-person Politburo was sentenced to nearly two decades in prison over a fraud charge. Government ministers have gone down too, and so have hundreds of other officials. Now, corruption is still rampant in Vietnam, says Dr. Nguyen, but many within government are sincere in trying to purge it.
Within the Communist Party of Vietnam, there's also members who really want to build a very clean party.
A clean, corruption-free party. Now, we don't know how Tho Lam paid for his gold-covered steak. But we do know his official salary, and it's about $800 per month. The steak dinner was probably double that, at least. It totally goes against the image that communist leaders are supposed to uphold. In Vietnam, there are no celebrity politicians, and no official is supposed to be all that rich. They're supposed to live fairly ordinary lives, just as their founding father Ho Chi Minh instructed.
Ho Chi Minh called on the party members to live a simple life with integrity, with ethics.
So is Minister Tho Lam in big trouble? Well, for now, Vietnam's government is acting like this dinner never happened. But they may have to act if more people see the video and get angry. Dr. Nguyen says citizens tend to like harsh punishments against shady officials.
It's really a big challenge for the Communist Party of Vietnam and for the government. They can't stop the social media. They can't stop the internet.
And let this be a warning to other world leaders. Salt Bae loves attention. He will not keep your dinner secret. That's Salt Bae in a 2018 video chopping up a steak. And if you can make out that deep voice in the background, it's Nicolas Maduro, president of Venezuela, enjoying an expensive feast while malnutrition was rampant back home. It was a video that many Venezuelans did not like. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
In Quebec, you speak French. It is the official language of the province. So when the head of Air Canada delivered a speech in English in Quebec last week, look out. Reporter Emma Jacobs in Montreal has been following this story. Emma, how did this all start?
So it's not just the speech. This was Michael Rousseau's first big address as head of the company. And in public, he was speaking to the Chamber of Commerce in Montreal, where Air Canada is headquartered. But then afterwards, a reporter asked him in French, how did he live in Montreal for 14 years without speaking the language? And the first thing he does is he asks him to repeat the question in English so he's sure he understands it, and then responds that he's been able to live in Montreal without speaking French, and then that's a real testament to the city of Montreal. And he says he's been too busy to learn French. So the thing is, as soon as this video starts circulating online, it's immediately clear that this was not the right answer. This was not the right thing to say. And it provokes this really big reaction, starting in Quebec.
So much to tease apart there. Lots of reasons why this upset people so much in Quebec. But what's kind of at the top of the list?
So language has always been really sensitive in Quebec. And the answer came off, I think, as very dismissive of French and of Francophones. It plays to the stereotype of English speakers who expect Francophones to learn French while not learning English, which is not even really true of the historically English-speaking community in Quebec. And it also really evokes this sort of sensitive historical era when a lot of the heads of big Montreal companies were English speakers and their employees were French. Montreal has historically been where most of the English speakers have been in Quebec and where a lot of new arrivals land. So that's always made it kind of the center of a lot of anxiety and arguments about the future of French.
Well, this speech in English happened just as the government in Quebec is trying to dramatically strengthen protections for the French language amid fears that English is overtaking it. Talk about that campaign and how it coincided with what Air Canada's official Michael Rousseau did in English.
So it is top of mind because you have some of the biggest language protection legislation that's been introduced in many years. And it is controversial with English communities because it could mean that some people lose the rights to government services in English, which in Canada means things like healthcare. And this legislation is really about this sort of anxiety about the demographics of French speakers and you know, whether this French corner can hold on in largely English-speaking North America.
Have Prime Minister Trudeau or other Canadian politicians commented on Michael Rousseau's English speech?
Yeah, so the provincial politicians weighed in first. A lot of national politicians, including the Prime Minister, have weighed in. He called it unacceptable.
And I see many want Rousseau to resign because of this speech in English to Montreal's Chamber of Commerce. Is that a possibility?
It's hard to say. I think at this point, he's definitely going to have to learn French. Air Canada said he's in classes. And the Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, sent a letter to Air Canada on Monday saying that learning French should be part of Rousseau's performance review. She also suggested that French should become part of the requirements for the top job at the airline.
English-speaking visitors to Montreal know they're better off speaking French, but as a one-time frequent visitor myself, I never felt I couldn't speak English. I just knew there was an advantage to speaking French. How much do you feel that sense of division between Anglophones and Francophones in Quebec?
You know, and in practice, it's a pretty interesting and bilingual city, but it's always political, it's always complicated, and one of the most surprising things about this whole story is that Rousseau could live here for 14 years and not realize that what he said was going to set off the response that it did.
Reporter Emma Jacobs in Montreal, thank you very much for unpacking this.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. As climate negotiators in Glasgow try to hash out the future of the planet, olive oil producers in the Middle East fret about the quality of their harvest.
The olives are a little smaller this year. The farmers say less rain means a smaller fruit, and that could mean a more pungent oil.
And have I told you lately that I'll sue you? Van Morrison's thoughts on COVID put him in hot water. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This week, joy at airports across the U.S. Fiancés, spouses, and grandparents reunited at last, with many COVID travel restrictions lifted after a year and a half.
This is my first time going overseas in over 2 years. It's very exciting. It was so great to get on the plane.
Jobs that have been passed over. There have been weddings that people have missed. And so, you know, I'm hoping that this means that we can come out of the pandemic together.
I'm on cloud nine, I can say.
On cloud nine, some voices there of passengers arriving at the Newark, Washington, and San Francisco airports. A half a world away in New Zealand, the reunions are much harder to arrange. New Zealand remains one of the most closed-off places in the world. As the world's Alana Gordon reports, for families that are separated, the situation has been a nightmare and has brought up some uneasy questions about the human cost of keeping out COVID.
When I spoke to Walter Spears last month, he told me he needs to get back to New Zealand.
I mean, I would leave tonight if I could. Like, for real.
He was visiting Tennessee, where he's originally from, taking care of some family issues. His wife, Roshni Sami, is pregnant with their first child. She's home in New Zealand. For weeks, she's been in lockdown, caring for her sick mom.
It's very lonely. And you sort of feel the sadness. And I guess during pregnancy, you really realize how vulnerable you are. And you sort of have a desire to be comforted. And there's just no one to comfort you.
Under New Zealand's strict travel system, it wasn't a sure bet that Walt would even make it back for the birth. The baby is due Christmas Eve.
I really don't feel like I can personally do this for much longer. Like, I just need to rest.
I've been gone too long. She needs my assistance, and time is not on her side.
Entering New Zealand during the pandemic has been a major challenge, even for citizens. To book a flight, you have to secure a voucher in a mandatory quarantine and isolation spot called an MIQ. It's a designated place, like a hotel, where anyone who lands in the country has to remain for 2 weeks, and you have to pay for it, thousands of dollars. Alexandra Burt is a lawyer with the volunteer group Grounded Kiwis, made up of New Zealanders stuck abroad.
So the initial system was kind of a first-in-first-serve system where vouchers would randomly be released at any time of the day or night. The problem being, hundreds if not thousands of people were trying to book that exact same date as you. So it was a kind of fastest finger first situation.
Burt says this setup put older adults, people with poor internet access, at a real disadvantage. Some gamed the system, paying people to refresh every few seconds. Others developed bots. Even with all that, the dates of the vouchers might not be for weeks or months.
It's completely uncertain. So people are sort of forced with the situation of, do they extend their lease or do they find short-term accommodation? Do they quit their job? Do they try and find a job? People have their visas expired.
People can apply for emergency exceptions to skip this process, but the government rarely grants them. This summer, when a big Delta surge hit New Zealand, the country paused the whole voucher process. A few weeks later, it switched to a lottery system. Walt was one of some 30,000 people vying for just 4,000 spots.
We were just really worried about my health and the stress. We really panicked.
Their emergency application was rejected. Pregnancy isn't a criteria. They reapplied. Roshni went all out. She got letters of support from the College of Obstetricians and Midwives, from women's rights groups. She took her story public and connected with a lawyer, Tudor Klee, who filed a challenge.
Oh, we're working with a dozen, more than that. Roshni started a movement.
According to New Zealand's border control, at least 70 emergency applications of pregnant couples have been rejected. Roshni thinks the true number is much higher. She says it's hard to reconcile all this with New Zealand's positive reputation for keeping COVID out.
I think it will be a really invisible cost because overall, you know, New Zealanders haven't had a terrible experience of COVID. But then in these small pockets, there have been these like absolute experiences of cruelty.
It's not just New Zealand. Until last week, Australia had closed its borders even to citizens. A UN Human Rights Committee stated that Australia's refusal to admit its own citizens was a breach of international law. Recently, New Zealand announced it would start to loosen some restrictions, but travelers still need a quarantine spot to get in.
I say it to her all the time, I love you, and you know, hopefully I'll be there sooner than later.
Sometimes I imagine in my mind those desolate American westerns where you're just in this prairie house, like by yourself, you know, and you just become this kind of like ruthless, independent woman who's looking after a farm by herself.
On Monday, those months of isolation finally came to an end.
Walt! Walt!
In this video Roshni sent me from the airport in Auckland, she waves Walt down as he walks into the pickup area.
Hi, babe.
Ooh, hey.
Walt is beaming, reunited for the first time in months. He rubs her tummy. She tells him the baby has been kicking a lot lately.
Isn't that crazy? Uh-huh. Such a big tummy.
Before their case went to court, the government granted their emergency application. Walt had just 36 hours to get a flight. He quarantined on a nearby island. I reconnected with the two of them right after they got back to their place together.
It feels cosmic, you know, to not have to fight or worry or wait anymore. Mm-hmm. Like it's, everything's okay.
So
it's like such a relief.
But it's still upsetting. They know others are still waiting, their baby's due dates nearing. The group Grounded Kiwis recently filed a claim against the New Zealand government over what they allege has been an unlawful and unreasonable system for managed isolation and quarantine. That hearing is scheduled for early next year. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Now to Glasgow. If you've been following the news, you know what this is about. We're in week two of the UN Climate Conference. The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, is in Glasgow at COP26 and joins me now. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey, Marco.
You spoke with someone who is representing a bloc of the most climate-vulnerable nations in the world, island nations. You spoke with Mohamed Nasheed. Who is he?
He's the Speaker of the Parliament in the Maldives currently. He has long been an outspoken advocate for action on climate change, and he was the president of the island nation of the Maldives when the Paris Agreement was signed. And it's because of leaders from small island and vulnerable nations like his that the big overarching goal of the summit is what it is, to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. And keeping that goal alive is one of the big stated goals of this summit.
And what progress has been made toward that goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius over time?
Well, in the real world, emissions have continued to rise. When you talk about what countries are saying they're going to do, there has been progress. Estimates suggest that before the Paris Agreement was signed, the world was on track for about 4 degrees Celsius of warming. Now, if every country lives up to the pledges they've made for 2030 through the UN process, and that's a big if, we'd be on track for about 2.4 degrees Celsius of warming. So still pretty far off the goal. Now, if you take into account the announcements and promises that don't have any details, don't have any enforcement mechanisms attached, so net zero targets and the carbon and methane pledges made here in Glasgow that we talked about last week, Marco, that number would go down to about 1.8 degrees Celsius. But we have already seen 1.2 degrees Celsius of warming so far, and emissions would have to come down dramatically very soon to keep the 1.5 degree target in reach. A lot of scientists say, you know, that ship has sailed. So I started out by asking former President Nasheed, do you think that goal is still even possible?
I can't afford to think that 1.5 degrees is not attainable. I can't afford to think that. That would be a death sentence on our countries and many low-lying islands and coastal regions. When we came to the COP, we were looking at 2.7 degrees, but with many other submissions and agreements, it's now looking like 1.7 degrees. I am hopeful that we can reach 1.5. We have a window of about 7 years, and we must do it during this period.
What does it mean for the Maldives if we don't hit the 1.5 degree target?
It means we're dead, just simply dead. A whole country gone, a whole people gone, a whole society gone, a whole community gone. You know, 2,000 years of culture gone. And this is the case with many, many low-lying islands.
The climate vulnerable nations that you represent are asking for countries to come with new carbon-cutting pledges every year. It's my understanding that that's not in this very early draft text of a COP decision. Why is it so important to come back to the table yearly? And who is against this plan to accelerate the action?
We need to make sure that we are at 1.5 to make sure that we reach that, we have to keep monitoring and auditing. I mean, most countries who have a climate change act requires them to submit a carbon budget every year to the parliament. There's no reason why they should resist this. All what we are suggesting is just be a little bit more ambitious than the previous year.
Are you happy with the progress that's been made toward 1.5 so far?
I am far more optimistic than, let's say, I was 4 years ago. I think it is moving in that direction. Sadly, though, it is because we are seeing bad weather upon every country. 200 people dying in Germany of floods, in Belgium, tundra burning, Serbia fires, Greece fires, China is flooded. It's there to be seen. The pictures are very vivid. Therefore, the public realizes that something needs to be done.
Back in 2009, you very famously, when you were president of the Maldives, held a cabinet meeting underwater while you were scuba diving to illustrate what sea level rise would mean for your country. If you were to go back to that same spot now in 2021, would it look different?
Yes, the reef would have died. The fish would have gone. If you go to the same spot, you will see that the reef is far more dead, bleached, than it was during 2009.
You were just mentioning the impacts on, you know, ecosystems and the reefs. What does that translate to when it comes to the lives of people in the Maldives?
Coastal erosion happens because of wave energy. And the wave energy is checked by the reef and the seagrass and the mangrove implanted on the shores. Now, when you don't have the reef, when you don't have the seagrass or the mangrove, then we have coastal erosion. And with coastal erosion, we lose homes, we lose hospitals, we lose schools, we lose roads, we lose a way of life.
President Nasheed, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Carolyn, you asked former President Mohamed Nasheed of the Maldives there about vulnerable countries' demand that everyone submit new pledges every year. Is that likely to happen?
I think that is not super likely because of the work it takes for countries to report out their emissions through this UN bureaucracy. But it does appear like one way this UN process hopes to keep 1.5 alive is by speeding up the process of taking stock of where countries are and what more they can do. Under the Paris Agreement, countries were supposed to come back to the table in 2020. Now it's 2021 because of the pandemic. And in 2025 to submit new pledges, which are called nationally determined contributions here at the UN. And there is a lot of talk about, you know, maybe moving up those timelines. There's going to be a draft published of the COP decision. So a big overarching decision that will be published out of this summit is going to be published overnight tonight. And the president of the COP hinted to me today that there might be reference to changed timeframes in that document. So we'll just have to see.
The World's Carolyn Beeler in Glasgow covering COP26, the UN Climate Summit. Thanks very much for the latest. Talk soon.
You're welcome, Marco.
Our coverage from COP26 is produced in partnership with the global media collaboration Covering Climate Now. As negotiators in Glasgow hammer out the policy details that aim to limit global warming, people all over the world, as many of us know from personal experience, are already dealing with the impacts of climate change. In the Holy Land, for example, farmers say the olive harvest is not what it used to be. One irony here, for millennia, the olive branch has been the symbol of peace. And perhaps no coincidence, both Israelis and Palestinians cultivate olives following the predictable 2-year growth cycle of olive trees. One year, the trees produce lots of fruit. The following year, not so much. But now a changing climate is disrupting that cycle. Daniela Cheslow is a reporter with Agence France-Presse in Jerusalem. So, Daniela, you've been spending some time in the Palestinian territory in the West Bank. What are you hearing about this year's olive harvest?
Marco, I visited this one village in the northern West Bank, Asira Shamalia, and olive farmers were everywhere, riding donkeys to their fields, hauling sacks of olives to the presses. The mayor also grows olives, Hazem Yassin, and he told me the climate challenge is not just rising temperatures, it's also less rain that's hard to plan around.
Huge quantity fall in 1 month, and the next 2 months, no rain. This is abnormal distribution affect seriously on the olive orchards.
And farmers told me they're seeing a pretty disappointing harvest this year, just after last year's was weak too.
So how do we know that this isn't just about the usual fluctuations in the weather?
Well, both Israelis and Palestinians told me the fluctuations go back at least a decade, which means it's been around 10 years since you could rely on that one-year good, one-year bad cycle. And experts on both sides told me if farmers don't adapt, the future for rain-fed trees does not look good.
We know olives are a staple crop for Israelis and Palestinians. What are people doing about this in order to keep this centuries-old crop for future generations?
Israel is funding a tech-heavy approach at the Volcani Center for Agricultural Research. An olive expert there, Giora Ben-Ari, walked me through an orchard of 120 exotic olive varieties from all around the world, and he's trying to find which could survive global warming. He says so far, two breeds showed promise. One is the Barnea, which was bred in Israel, and one is the Suri, originally from Lebanon.
So the Suri is resistant in terms of oil quality. The Barnea is resistant in terms of yield. We still didn't identify one super cultivar who show resistance in all parameters.
And Ben-Ari is also testing for how to cool down olives at key points, you know, maybe just a week or two, using shade or irrigation.
What about the Palestinians? Are they able to test new cultivars?
Well, Palestinians face limitations that the Israelis don't face. For example, the water they use for irrigation can cost at least six times as much as what an Israeli farmer would pay because the Israeli military restricts Palestinian drilling. And that price is before you factor in the cost of trucking that water to the fields. So only about 5% of Palestinian-owned olive trees are irrigated compared to a quarter of Israelis. In Asira Shamalia, the village I visited, people are focused on doing more with less. I saw a brand new gleaming Italian olive press. 52 farmers banded together and bought it. They said it would minimize the leaks of olive oil out of old equipment. And one farmer told me he's pruning his trees heavily to get more out of every drop of rain.
Mm. Daniela, I'm curious, can you taste the impact of climate change on the current harvest of olives?
I have a bottle of olive oil from that olive press in Asira Shamalia. It's peppery, it's thick. I couldn't tell you if it's thicker because the olives are more thirsty, but I can tell you the olives are a little smaller this year. The farmers say less rain means a smaller fruit, and that could mean a more pungent oil, although you should probably talk to an expert for that one.
Daniela Ceslo, reporter with the Jerusalem Bureau of Agence France-Presse. Thank you very much. Good to talk.
Thanks, Marco.
When Joe Biden was running for president, he pledged to stop U.S. support for the ruling family of Saudi Arabia. At one debate, he said the Saudis must be held accountable for the humanitarian consequences of the war in Yemen and for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
Days after taking office this year, President Biden echoed his campaign promise.
We're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
But last week, the Biden administration said it would sell $650 million worth of U.S.-made missiles to Saudi Arabia. Here to explore this apparent contradiction is William Hartung. He's a director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center for International Policy and joins us from New York. What has the U.S. agreed to sell to Saudi Arabia exactly?
They're selling $650 million worth of air-to-air missiles built by Raytheon, formal name Advanced Medium Range Air-to-Air Missiles, or AMRAAM.
What are these missiles going to be used for by the Saudi military?
Well, according to the Pentagon, primarily to shoot down drones, either from Iran or from the Houthi rebels in Yemen.
So would you characterize this as a president going back on his word?
Yes, I would. I think this is no time to be selling arms of any kind to Saudi Arabia, given its conduct in Yemen. It's never really been held accountable for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and it's doing a blockade that's putting millions of Yemenis at risk. So by selling arms at this moment, it's kind of an endorsement of Saudi conduct.
What is exactly blocked right now? Explain the blockade.
Well, the biggest problem at the moment is the blockage of fuel coming into the Red Sea port of Hodeida. And that's resulted in hospitals not having enough electricity and not being able to transport humanitarian aid over ground to people that need it.
So who has been against this deal?
There's a whole array of human rights and humanitarian aid groups. There's a Yemeni diaspora in the United States that have raised issues basically on human rights grounds, but also on foreign policy grounds, that supporting this war diminishes U.S. influence and reputation in the region. And, you know, our hands are partly guilty for the humanitarian catastrophe there.
Biden was careful last February to say he would continue to help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty. So while the U.S. has blocked two sales of bombs to the Saudis, it continues to support the Saudi military in other ways, with this arms sale most recently. Can you just spell out this contradiction? I mean, what do you see?
Well, U.S. arms and spare parts and maintenance keep the Saudi Air Force flying. Without that support, some experts think it'd be a matter of days or weeks, their Air Force would be grounded, which would mean they couldn't do airstrikes. It'd be harder to enforce the blockade. And it could be used as leverage to get them to change their policies.
The U.S. has had close ties with Saudi Arabia since the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And even now we rely on a well-armed Saudi military to counter the regional threat from Iran. What else can President Biden do but walk this line between supporting a historic friend and criticizing its policies?
Well, I think he was right in the first place when he said we have to reconsider the nature of this relationship. I think trade is fine. I think once they get out of Yemen and once that war ends, there could be a reconsideration of defensive weaponry. I don't think, in fact, there'd be a major factor were there a conflict with Iran. And a conflict with Iran, as one expert said, would make Iraq look like a walk in the park. It's to be avoided, you know, by any means possible. So I think the U.S. doesn't depend on Saudis as much for oil as it used to. So I think it's time for a rethink of the whole relationship. And the fact that it's existed for decades doesn't mean it has to proceed on the same basis going forward.
After those kind of statements on the campaign trail, making Saudi pay the price and prove that they are the pariah that they are, has Joe Biden stated why he thinks this arms sale is a good idea right now?
I think basically the administration is saying it fits their kind of new concept, which is different from what he said on the campaign trail, that they'll supply what they call defensive weapons and not offensive weapons. And for a lot of weapon systems, they can be used in either mode. And also there's the question of arms sales as political support for the regime. So I think it's consistent with the way policy has shifted since his initial positive, I think, more constructive statements.
William Hartung is director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center for International Policy, unpacking for us the Biden administration's decision to resume arms sales to Saudi Arabia. William, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we told you earlier, the Glasgow Climate Conference continues this week in Scotland. This is the time for negotiators from each country to get down to the really hard work of carbon reduction. Head to theworld.org and dive into coverage of COP26, from the challenges facing environment activists in China to Saudi Arabia's pledge to get to net zero emissions by 2060. That's all at theworld.org. Sir George Ivan Morrison, better known as Van, is clear where he stands on the pandemic.
No more lockdown, no more government overreach, no more fascist police.
No more fascist police, Van Morrison sings in his single No More Lockdown that came out a year ago. The Belfast-born singer has been an outspoken critic of his government's approach toward COVID-19. He claims scientists make up crooked facts. He warns the public, unironically apparently, not to listen to celebrities.
No more celebrities telling us how we're supposed to feel.
Van Morrison has singled out Northern Ireland's health minister. Back in June, he told an audience what he really thinks about Robin Swan.
Robin Swan is very dangerous. Robin Swan is very dangerous. Robin Swan is very dangerous. Robin Swan is very dangerous.
That wasn't the only time Morrison went after the health minister. Swan has not sat by. Last year, he wrote an op-ed for Rolling Stone saying that Northern Ireland is very proud that one of the greatest musicians of the past 50 years comes from there. Then Swan went on to call the 76-year-old singer dangerous. He wrote that Van Morrison's words will give great comfort to the conspiracy theorists, the tinfoil hat brigade who crusade against masks and vaccines and think this is all a huge global plot to remove freedoms. And Robin Swan has not stopped there. Northern Ireland's health minister is suing Van Morrison for defamation. Van Morrison's lawyer says he'll fight the charges. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're online all the time at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.